The final play in the studio series is a new work called And All for Love by Alison Lawrence. But it, too, is inspired by a classical story and historical subject. Alison Lawrence is a performer, a writer, an actress. And about 20 years ago, she approached me with a project she was working on about the first actresses on the English stage. And as we mentioned earlier, up until 1660, women's roles were played by boys. And this was out of a need to control censorship on the theater, the idea that theaters promoted licentious behavior. Theater has always been the bastion of low moral standards. It was controlled by having boys, which meant that sexual depictions on the stage would remain as clean as they could. And in 1660, when the monarchy is restored and Charles had spent that time in France, comes back to England, he also brought with him the cultural practice of the theater that he loved. And this innovation of having women play women was one of them. And Alison was very interested in this history and who these women were. How did they learn to act? Where did they get their training? The theaters had been closed down by an ordinance in 1642, which forbade the public presentation of theater plays. Now, plays did continue subversively. They continued in court. They continued in special occasions. But the Globe Playhouse, the Wooden O that we've referred to, was empty. And so where did these women learn to act? And that was the point of departure for Alison's play. The title is a quote, and it's a quote of a play by John Dryden, who was the poet laureate during the Restoration. And he wrote a play called All for Love, which was his revision of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. And in the play, Cleopatra was played by the great Elizabeth Barry, who was the preeminent actress of the Restoration stage. She also originated the role of Mrs. Marwood in The Way of the World. So there's a little connection there. And Alison focused on two actors. And so when I knew we were doing a season that was inspired by classical plays and historical subject, I called up Alison and said, "Do you remember that play you were working on 20 years ago? Are you still interested?" And she said, "You know, I am." And she's collected an enormous amount of research, and she's interested in looking at it both historically, but also what does that say today? What does it say about women in the theater? What does it say about the role of the actress? What does it say about the actress as a metaphor for women in society? And she's focused on two actors of the period, Elizabeth Barry, as I mentioned, who was very, very celebrated, and another named Winifred Gosnell. And Winifred Gosnell was not so celebrated in her period. We know of her through the Samuel Pepys diaries. And in 1660, she was a maid working in Samuel Pepys' house. And after being quite frustrated with Pepys' persnickety house manners, she quits to join the stage. And Pepys does recount seeing her in a play several months later and remarks that she was surprisingly quite good. Then we never hear of her again. And the only other recording we have of Winifred Gosnell is 20 years later, she appears in a playbill as a member of the company in a small role. So what we know about her is that she forged a life living in the theater, but she didn't achieve the great heights that Elizabeth Barry did or Anne Bracegirdle did or the notoriety of a Nell Gwynn, who was a mistress who became an actress, and all part of those stories. Not unlike our own age, if we were, you know, yes, we all know about Nicole Kidman and Kate Winslet, but that is hardly fair to say that's the real life of most actors living now. And between these two women is Edward Kynaston. And Edward Kynaston was famous for his portrayal of women. And he was considered a great stage beauty and was the preeminent interpreter of women's roles, but fell out of favor when actresses on the stage became the new notion. I love thinking the actress on the stage of reading criticism from the period that go, oh, it's a fad. It'll pass. We'll return back to the good old ways of boys playing women. Sort of like, you know, Sensoround or Vibravision or the kind of response there was to the talkies when that happened. And it was a huge innovation. And Kynaston, Alison imagines, was the teacher to Barry and to Gosnell on how to behave. And so it opens up all kinds of social questions as well as theatrical ones. There was a man teaching women how to play women in the theater. Another thing she exploits in the play is the preponderance for the breeches role. And the breeches role were parts where women would pretend to be boys in order to gain access to a court. And you see that in Shakespeare's plays. Rosalind disguises herself as Ganymede in As You Like It. Viola disguises herself as Cesario in Twelfth Night. But breeches roles also afforded the public of London to see a lady's leg. Because she would be in breeches and stockings, and you could show off the female shape and form in exciting ways. So, And All for Love is a play that looks at the friendship between these two women, their relationship to men in the theater at that time, and an innovation that really did change the way we think about theater and might be the very first beginnings of what we call naturalism or realism, in that theater began to mimic how life really was and wasn't pure, only metaphorical. It became also a real chronicle. As we were talking about with Way of the World, the Restoration was an incredible time and far more complex than just a simple age of decadence, decay, or what, you know, there's a lot to this period. David, could you tell us a little bit about the theater companies and the patent? What happened when theater
was
made legal
again? Not a lot. No, I think
again?
That's more that you you know more about that. I do know that with the King coming back and founding the Theatre Royal and the King's Company, and then there's the Duke's Company, and there's these two rival companies that are competing with each other.
And that's how they chose to handle
that's
it.
That's how they chose to handle it.
We can deal with the censorship. Yeah. There can only be two.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and then there's, is it the 1670s or late 70s, where they come together for a very short period of time, the United Company. Yeah. And then that falls apart by the 1690s, is that
right? That's right.
It's not a very long-standing.
Well, yes, the United Company fell apart because when there were two companies, you can imagine the bartering for actors became very popular. And so if I really wanted, you know...
Anne Bracegirdle
in my production, I would offer her more money than the Duke's Company might. So the actors were able to make a lot, and it gave birth to the celebrity actor, Thomas Betterton, Anne Bracegirdle, certainly. They were stars, and that you could bill a play by featuring that Mrs. Bracegirdle would be in it. And the United Company, the actors got together to try to take over and control, but then the rates of pay fell down.
Right.
So that's why
it's an extraordinary world, isn't it? I mean, it reminds me of a couple of films that people may have seen, Shakespeare in Love, which I think captures very much the vibrancy and the competition and the range of involvements in the Elizabethan theater. But as you know, Alison gave her wonderful talk in the Ark on her research and on her play. And one of the actors, Kate, reminded me that there was told me about a film called Stage Beauty, which was about Kynaston and this very subject. And of course, I rushed out and watched it. And it's almost as good as Shakespeare in Love in conveying some of these issues and these debates. And I think it's very hard for us. We just take for granted that women will be playing women, and it must have been, you know, must have been shocking to see this suddenly on stage. And Pepys remarks about this in his remarkable diary, just what a change it was to see Desdemona acted by a woman, or to see several women on stage at the same time. And it must have challenged all sorts of social roles outside the theater. I know that there were lots of worries about what the status of these women were. In the Elizabethan period, players were often regarded as potential vagabonds because they wandered about acting in different places, particularly when the theaters closed down in the summers because of the risk of plague and so on. And they ran the risk of being arrested for being, you know, a vagabond or a rogue. And the same thing, a similar situation, I guess, emerges with the Restoration, is that women who are on stage, who are bearing their calves to the audience, who are performing as women, who are touching men, who are having those sorts of language discussions of love, are very, you know, in many men's eyes, would have seemed very similar to the prostitutes who were hanging outside the theaters, offering a different form of service. And I know there are lots of regulations that I've seen in the sources of hiring someone to guard the back rooms so that men who assume that it's their right to go backstage and just seduce or try and seduce or attack women who are acting to you know, prevent that happening. So there were many, many boundaries that these women had to negotiate in private and in public, and that must have been an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. In this particular period, I think it must have been a huge challenge. Issues of differences of pay, you know, you equal pay for equal work. You know, there's all those sorts of issues.
Yes, a little known fact is the word benefit is really associated with this period in terms of every theater had a benefit performance, and your salary, your salary was negligible for the most part. And to top up your salary or to get your worth, you were given a benefit performance. So we would do a show, and the proceeds of which would go to Anne Bracegirdle. Mm. And the, you know, the men got Saturday night, and the women got Tuesday afternoon, and things like that. And the benefit was a big part of your brokerage with the company. And so it was a whole different way of thinking about theater and what it was to sit in those playhouses that were loud. You know, we talk so much about etiquette in our own theater. You know, I get crazy when people are talking during a show. Well, I would have not been very happy in the Restoration. One theater made it their specialty that they offered seats on the stage. Mm-hmm. And you read actors' complaints of the audience getting up on the stage to walk over to talk to a friend while you're trying to play, you know, Caesar or something out there.
Who was the composer? Was it Haydn? I can't remember who came to London and was so angry with the audience, the crowd that just would not settle down, that he eventually began each symphony with some sort of huge percussive movement
crashing,
to sort of just let them know it was about to start and they should be quiet.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's
the other great innovation of the Restoration is the introduction of the proscenium arch. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare's plays and the theater of the Elizabethan and Jacobean period was in a thrust stage with audiences standing, the groundlings we mentioned before, open air. It was an expansive forum with big plays that took on several time periods all at once. In the Restoration, the theater moved inside. It got a lot more intimate. And the proscenium arch came into being, this framing with the perspective scenery that fell behind it. And one of my favorite descriptions is that the curtain and the proscenium are like an eye. And the curtain is an eyelid that opens, not to show you the outside world as we all see it, but the world as we imagine it to be. And it's a really beautiful idea. So the theater becomes a lot more intimate, a lot more reflective. And, of course, the ideals of verisimilitude, a unity of time, place, and action start to take precedence. Mm-hmm. And so we see the theater itself gets much closer to plays as they're written today. It's our really beginning of modern theater in that regard.
Mm-hmm.